Dylan kind of then introduced into this kind of artistic sensibility, this socio-political sensibility, when he went from folk music to rock music. And it created this whole new expectation that rock musicians, in addition to being entertainers, would also have to have something to say, or have a, you know, be artists, you know, be serious artists. So
I'm going to go out on a bit of a limb and suggest that almost any music listener, even a more casual music fan, has probably been privy to a conversation revolving around the idea of selling out. A conversation focused on what's happening or what might happen to a band who's suddenly faced with the seemingly intractable dilemma of making money. The conversation often highlighted by expressions and declarations of how much we like their early work and how so-and-so might dig that band, but he doesn't really get what they're actually about. For an artist on the other side of that conversation, what were once joyful and highly motivating dreams about making music or making art and also paying for her life are now thoughts weighed down by the possibility that many of those who helped her get there might leave because she'd made it. Art, like charity or justice work, has an odd public relationship with money. For many onlookers, the moment a creator turns even slightly one way or another towards a paycheck, the whole of their work is thrown into question. A kind of purity is threatened, if not lost. Why are you doing what you're doing? Isn't it about the art? Isn't this about people? Now, whether a work like music or hunger relief is actually less valuable or less pure, or if it's at least partially motivated by the desire to pay for bread, well, perhaps that's an unanswerable question on the cultural level. But when examined case by case, the motives and the intentions of culture makers, those tell fascinating stories, sometimes stories more vital and apocalyptic than the works those makers have applied themselves to. This is the At Sea Podcast, and I'm your host, Justin McRoberts. My guest on this episode is music historian Adam Karas. Having spent the better part of two decades around the music industry as a performer and a writer and a booking agent, etc., Adam now teaches in the music business program at Montreat College in North Carolina. My conversation with him focuses primarily on his book entitled, and I love this title, The Day Alternative Music Died, Dylan, Zeppelin, Punk, Alt, Glam, Majors, Indies, and the Struggle Between Art and Money for the Soul of Rock. We dive into our conversation with a quick glance back in his history at his religious upbringing. Check it out. You were raised in an evangelical setting and you practice your faith as a Catholic now.
That is true. Yep.
Was there a moment for you? Was like sort of a transition? Was it a necessary transition, or you just like it kind of just happened? Or
no, I mean, I knew a lot of kind of ex-evangelicals. I mean, a lot of people. I went to Gordon College
in Boston.
In Boston.
Yeah.
And I never rejected Christianity. I don't know if I even thought about the term evangelical particularly. That much. But I went through a period where my faith became something that wasn't necessarily deliberate in my life.
Yeah, okay.
I was more interested in, you know, playing in a rock band and doing that type of stuff.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And it never rejected it or had any hard feelings toward it, just something that wasn't necessarily deliberate in my life.
Huh.
And that became at some point untenable. There are just too many questions about why am I doing X, Y, or Z that I wasn't finding the answers to,
right,
you know, in my, you know, daily life. And, you know, just so I, in coming to try and think about and answer questions, I kind of read, what do I think about Christianity? Is this something I care about? Is this something that's essential to me? And when I came back at it that way, my parents had become Catholic at that point. They were also evangelicals, and they'd been, you know, slipping, you know, me copies of the catechism, you know, here, you know, or stuff like that, you know. You know, very good-naturedly, they weren't, you know, oppressive about it, but there was a long time that I wasn't even going to consider that because that was what my parents were doing.
Oh, fascinating.
You know, I mean, that was just not on the table. But then eventually I just, you know, picked up a copy of the catechism, and it wasn't at all what I had expected, you know, which was a list of rules or something.
Right, right.
You know, and it, but the doctrine was actually really beautiful, and even just from its very opening preamble that, you know, God everywhere, you know, moves, draws close to us as humans, you know, and just this desire that God
desires us, and it's just right in the preamble. I was like, this wasn't what I thought this was supposed to be, a list of don't do this and don't do that. That's how I guess I had this idea of what Catholicism was. And so instead of that, it was very inviting. And then when you get into the doctrine, and I was just, it was just beautiful and had a lot of nuance, and was the answers and things I found there were kind of beyond what I even could have imagined would be there in some ways. So,
and I mean, and the Catholic world ends up being the one in which you've got, you know, was it 92 or so, or maybe before that, it was when the Pope, who's John Paul at the time, mm-hmm. wrote a letter to artists.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if I'm familiar with the letter to artists.
Yeah, but I haven't read. Yeah.
But I mean, it's just it's similar. He doesn't draw this line between mm-hmm. like, here's what sacred art looks mm-hmm. like, or sacred music, and here, you know, Catholic rock.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there, like, you don't get the whole, like, here's the Catholic rock and here's a line between, but here's the Pope talking about the nature of art, period.
Mm-hmm.
And rooted in the soul of people who are by their nature in relationship to a creative God, creative in themselves, and that all creativity in some way, shape, or form is like reflective of their of human relationship to the divine. That's just a sentiment that's so incredibly foreign
mm-hmm.
from, or you know, foreign to maybe a more traditionally evangelical mind, in which like we end up drawing a lot more lines between like, well, I'm not going to look for like hints of any sort of like divine inspiration in like a, you know, with, especially at that time, in like a Nine Inch Nails.
Sure, sure.
But like, boy, you really should.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that there, what I've found is there's a long tradition of that in the Catholic Church. I mean, are you familiar with Jacques Maritain? And he's a Catholic philosopher, but was very influential throughout the 20th century, but had some great writing on art that was very influential, I think, on Pope John Paul as well. But yeah, it was, I mean, it's something that's there. There's the richness of Catholic thought. And, you know, I came into it kind of in a vacuum, in the sense that I can empathize with a lot of people who have baggage with Catholic practice and all kinds of that type of stuff. And I almost got like to kind of skip that, you know, and just kind of go. So I understand people have, you know, kind of some baggage with that type of stuff, but just coming at it from kind of through the catechism and through the kind of the beauty of the doctrine and the discourse and the nuance and all of that type, and the mystery of it as well.
Mm.
There's a lot of that you have to kind of hold in tension, and that that was fascinating to me. I don't like that. But it was challenging in a way that was refreshing.
Yeah, a couple. One of our guests earlier in the years is a songwriter named Audrey Assad, who also practices her faith as a Catholic, and mm-hmm. she talks about this challenge that she felt and heard from Thomas Merton about that to be fully human means to hold things in tension.
Mm-hmm.
To if you're going to believe in God in any way, shape, or form, you have to be able to hold things mm-hmm. in tension. Wow, that, and no one, at some point, depending on what you're holding in tension, no one really wants that.
Right, right.
But you don't really get that choice. It's just how you end up managing that. And your faith is supposed to guide you in that, as opposed to try to dismiss it.
And kind of coming to accept it and not try and change it. You can't intellectualize that away.
Yeah.
And if you try, you're going to lose some of the really important nuance.
Yeah. So your band that you were playing in, like back in the day, you're talking about, you was more when, like when you were in college.
Yeah.
What kind of band, what kind of music were you guys making?
From the time I was 20 to the time I was 30, I started a band when I was in college. It was called The Troubadours, and we played in Boston. I mean, it was at Gordon College, you know, I was there, and there was a really cool kind of music scene going on at that college at that time. Most of my friends were either in bands or loved music. It was just a really exciting time. It was kind of this tail end of the alternative, like it's kind of what we were talking about, around the time of, you know, REM and Nirvana and all of these really cool alternative bands that were really inspirational to us. And so all these bands at the college sounded a lot different from each other because there was so much diversity.
Yeah, kind
of that, you know, the Pixies were a big influence. They were kind of a Boston-based band at the time, and Buffalo Tom and some of these other bands. So there was that. So that was, it felt very natural to kind of start a band. It didn't feel like something that was beyond our reach as people. So that was, and we had a very kind of supportive community, all went to each other's shows and all this type of stuff. And so that started when I was in college, and went on mostly interrupted for about 10 years. The interesting thing about it is that as you know, I'm the oldest of four kids. And when we, as my siblings got older, and we were, you know, came from kind of a musical family, our parents are musicians. And as we kind of got older, I would notice, like, when my brother came to Gordon, I think I was a senior, he was a freshman, I was like, well, he's really a lot better guitar player than the guitar players I've been meeting around here. Maybe I should, you know, get him in the band. And so he joined the band, and then my parents moved from Michigan to Boston at the time. So they were nearby, and my sister was just, like, becoming this kind of prodigy on the bass at, like, age 16. And so we just were like, well, maybe talk to my parents. Like, can she come out and play shows at, like, clubs and stuff? Are you going to...
And let's be honest, there's, like, there's not much cooler than a really great female bass player.
Well, yeah. I mean, she was a great bass player regardless of, you know, her gender. But it was like she got... I mean, people were just like... And her age, too. I mean, people would just be like, who is this playing bass
that's so
like this?
Cool.
So it was really cool. So then... And then it wasn't until years later that my youngest brother joined playing keyboards. So we had, like, all four siblings in a band. And so the music was just really fun and really great. We had kind of an intuitive knowledge of where each other were going with these common kind of touch points, and it was great. It was also a little bit hard to be taken seriously as, like, because you'd get pegged as, like, a family band. And we didn't want to be the Partridge Family, you know. We wanted to be, you know, the Pixies or whatever,
right,
or U2 or something, you know. And or eventually, you know, whoever else you're listening to, Wilco or something, you know.
Right.
So we wanted to be, like, in that. So, it, you know, it was, you know, it was frustrating sometimes, but the music was really good. I mean, and the, I mean, we were a better, I look back and I was a decent songwriter, but the band together live, what was really good about that band. So, like, my favorite recording of that band, we did a live record close to the time before we, broke up, and that's still my favorite record because it kind of captured what we did live. We made other albums, but it was that record.
And nothing really helps you fall in love with music than learning to play. Like, you can, like, love music from a distance, but actually being able to pick up an instrument and, like, get into a song that you love and play around with it, or, like, let something come out of you.
Sort
of. Were you? I mean, you grew up as a fan of music. Did you consider yourself, like, a student of music growing up? Were you studying music? Was it, like, did you always pay attention to music the same way you did in, like, putting together the book?
Well, we didn't really have much choice because my dad, like, I think our music listening was really curated in a way that I'm really thankful for. Like, there was always, you know, he would play, you know, early, you know, rock music, and we'd get the story behind, you know, Elvis or the story behind the Beatles or, you know, whatever it was. And then he was a huge, and is to this day, a huge soul music fan. So we knew, like, all the backstory of Otis Redding, and we went to, like, where his plane crashed and all this different stuff. But this sense of kind of, like, timeline too, like, this kind of influenced that, which influenced this, and kind of trying to make a linear narrative out of, like, what can be a really amorphous, disjointed history of music. Was something that we got, like, at a young age, just kind of through osmosis, just by my dad telling stories about it. You know, he was just a huge music fan. He wrote a biography of Hank Williams that was for some period of time kind of like the definitive biography of Hank Williams. Since, I think there have been a number of other ones that have kind of surpassed it. But, you know, he published that. So, I mean, some of my earliest memories were, you know, being down in Nashville while he was doing research. And
that's really cool.
Yeah, so
I mean, you learned to pay attention to music and, like, beyond the sort of, like, personal cathartic, I'm having a moment with the song thing, and really think, like, of music in its history and in its place and the people behind it.
I think that came first, actually. I mean, kind of the story aspect and the narrative and just, like, the history aspect of it came almost before. You know, it wasn't, you know, whatever age it is where you start really connecting to music, you know, whether it's high school or whatever, junior high, you know, that comes. But leading into that, I already had almost a framework for understanding it, which was really interesting.
Do you remember having a first, like, real deep connection with a band or an artist?
I mean, yeah, there were quite a few. I mean, the big change for me was when I was the summer I turned 13, we moved from, we had been living in Rockford, Illinois, mm-hmm. outside, just west of Chicago, which is kind of a suburban place. We loved growing there. It was a great place to be a kid. But there wasn't as much kind of cultural exposure and that type of thing. So, but I mean, before you're 13, I don't know how much I would have really resonated.
Hit the clubs.
Well, I don't know how much I would have resonated with the music anyway. So being at that kind of age, we moved to Los Angeles and just started, somehow got turned onto the K-Rock, KROQ music station, and just was just discovered this amazing, you know, world of music, and I just kind of loved it all, you know.
Yeah.
It was, you know, The Cure and R.E.M. and U2 and Depeche Mode and the Sugar Cubes and the Pixies and all this just like stuff, you know. Man. And it was just a great, I was just like, wow, I didn't, you know. And it was, and at that point, that was my stuff too, because my parents were music people, but they weren't into that, you know. So it was stuff that I was finding, and I had a couple of older friends, and I had an older friend who was turning me onto some of that stuff at the same time too. So he would be, you know, have the new like Pet Shop Boys record or something like that, and you know, oh, let's listen to that, or all this, you know, like older U2 records, which I hadn't, you know, I wasn't aware of. All I knew was like the Joshua Tree. He's like, oh, we really have to listen to War, you know. That's where it's at, you know. So I had some good curation there too. But like K-Rock was really kind of the first music. And so, and I don't know if I could name, U2 was a big influence, but it was just so much music.
But it was the station.
And
in the story, and I'd love to talk about your book for a minute. And
sure.
The book is called The Day Alternative Music Died.
Yeah.
Which is a great book. Mm-hmm. I read it to you twice. It's such a, and I, like I was telling you earlier, I've passed it on to a lot of folks. But K-Rock, the radio station, plays, I mean, similar, like it plays this personal role in your life, but it also plays a pretty significant cultural moment, which I'd love for you to get to, because the radio is really different now than the way it used to be. Maybe we'll use that as a launching pad. What I'd love to do is, like, I'd love to talk about K-Rock as a radio station, and like, because we've talked about curation and your dad curating some stuff, and then K-Rock was really actually kind of doing this cultural curation thing, which doesn't really happen on radio anymore. So I'd love to talk about like what they were doing and maybe kind of some of the history around it. And then after that, maybe jump back and kind of give the grand narrative from your book about what happened, why what K-Rock was doing was so good and necessary. So tell me about K-Rock, your experience and kind of the history there.
Well, when I was just listening to it, I didn't know really any of the history at the time.
Right.
You know, I was just, this was just this amazing radio station that was playing all this kind of, all over the spectrum. I mean, you had Morrissey and you had, you know, Tori Amos and you had, you know, it was just like all over the map as far it was. And then you had like the kind of pre-grunge bands. You had Soundgarden, and you just had all these just different bands that were all different from each other. There wasn't any genre to it, you know, which was really fun and exciting. So you got to hear a real variety of stuff. But it wasn't mainstream, you know. I wasn't necessarily like one of the popular kids, but I also wasn't like a total outcast either. I was kind of just in this kind of in between place, and it was important to me. I think there were people who was even more important to. I think a lot of that music and the scene that was kind of created around it, because it was really a scene. It wasn't just the music. K-Rock would put on like a lot of local shows, and a lot of them were all ages shows. So I couldn't go down. You know, I couldn't go see a lot of these bands that were playing like the Sunset Strip. You know, I couldn't go see Guns N' Roses at the Whiskey or whatever it was.
Right, because it's a 21 and over show.
Yeah. Or at least 18, you know, and I'm in high school. So, but K-Rock would have a lot of, you know, all ages shows. They had this huge festival every Christmas. It was like called Almost Acoustic Christmas, which I think maybe still exists to this day.
I think it does, yeah.
And it started out as kind of like an acoustic showcase, but they ended up kind of abandoning it. They kept the name.
Hence the Almost.
Yeah. So it wasn't that way. But I mean, you'd go see, you know, 20 bands in one show or over the course of a couple of days. They started a summer one that was called the Weenie Roast, that was another kind of festival where they just get all these bands. So you'd see all these bands that you heard on the radio. They all would come through.
Yeah.
And they did smaller shows too. So it was, there was a whole culture built up around that. And I think there, for a lot of people who didn't fit in with what was going on in like mainstream rock, or thought that pop music, they wanted more from their music than kind of Don't Need Nothing But a Good Time, like that Poison type, you know, like they wanted something more from that, or needed something more from that. They found kind of a real connection and community in that community.
And what they were doing, I mean, they were pretty intentional. It wasn't like,
Oh, absolutely.
Just like, it wasn't just like, oh, we happened to stumble across this stuff, but what the folks at K-Rock was doing, I mean, they were doing, they were really intentionally like working against the mainstream. There's a little bit of a story there about like that. Can you tell us a little bit?
Sure. And frankly, I think that there, by the time I was listening to K-Rock, there were people who'd been listening to K-Rock who already thought that they'd sold out, you know, by what they're, you know, I think that there were purists who, you know, already thought that, but because they were playing bands that, you know, might have a gold record or something. But, no, but K-Rock, I mean, in the research for the book, I mean, well, let me start here. The impetus for the book was that this whole, the word alternative was really remembered differently than I had experienced it. So K-Rock was an alternative radio station. There was this alternative culture. When I arrived at college, there were all these people that kind of were just from this alternative culture that music was important for, but it was a social thing as well. It was kind of outside the mainstream. And
yeah.
And that was what I had experienced. And at some point, alternative in the 90s got transferred into this like genre of music of like angsty white dudes, you know, who were, you know, and there's a whole list of bands, you know, whether it was Bush and Creed and eventually Nickelback and, you know, all these bands that had this like alternative tag. But what it meant, it didn't mean apart from the mainstream, it meant this mainstream genre of angsty white dudes, you know. Huh. And whereas the music that we were listening to was very diverse and wasn't all, you know, guitar rock, you could have very kind of sensitive stuff that worked. There's a lot of female artists.
Yeah.
And so the gender stereotyping was a lot looser in those, as I remembered it. So, but now in the cultural remembrance, alternative rock means those kind of like angsty dudes, you know, singing, you know, and it's who all sounded like Eddie Vedder or Matchbox 20 or something,
right,
you know.
Right.
So that was what was remembered, and I was like, this other part that I experienced, and like so many people, like when I showed up at college, there were people coming from all around the country who were like experiencing this. So I knew it wasn't just like something that only happened in LA.
Yeah.
So I knew I had this, and it just didn't seem to be in the cultural remembrance. And there had been books written about punk music, a lot of really good books written about punk. That Michael Azarod book, Our Band Could Be Your Life, about indie music was a great catalog. That and there wasn't something about alternative music, so I wanted to write about that
because there was a thread.
Yeah,
the you know, for a band, or the thing that tied together, because on the radio station, you're right, you would hear the Smiths, and then it would be the Sugar Cubes, which not at all sound like the Smiths, and then you would have
Depeche Mode,
you know. Way outside, it's more this digital kind of thing, like sort of like EDM before there was EDM, and then you would come around to something like a Pearl Jam.
Yeah,
which is a kind of a rock band.
Yeah, but they're in there.
But they're in there.
And they're part of it too.
But you call it alternative, and so you wanted to tie together like this is what made alternative, and it's not the sound,
right?
Which is really interesting because like eventually it does become like here's the stuff that sold best, so we're going to call this alternative, and then bastardize the whole thing.
Yeah, and so then in researching the book, I realized how influential K-Rock had actually been in crafting what alternative came to be.
Yeah.
And so it had been a kind of a revolutionary rock station in the late 70s, playing kind of punk and post-punk and new wave stuff, just weird stuff, you know, at the time. But that was kind of revolutionary because FM radio had become kind of really homogenized at that time. And so it kind of built this cult following. And then their program director, Rick Carroll, It became kind of like this cult following, and then there was other radio stations around the country that's like, hey, there's something going on there.
Yeah.
Can you come, you know, oversee a reformatting of our station? And so he started doing that at, you know, dozens of radio stations around the country. And so K-Rock's imprint of, you know, playing kind of this outsider, you know, music went around the country based on his reformatting. So, you know, from Cleveland to San Diego to, you know, just all these different places, to Dallas, all these places, to Boston, had K-Rock influence radio stations. And so the terminology of alternative really came from one of those stations that he influenced was WFNX in Boston, which was owned by the Phoenix, which was their alternative arts paper. And so they kind of talked about it as, you know, alternative was a word they used. And then they were influential because it was Boston's such a college town. And then there were all these college radio stations that had very similar playlists. I mean, alternative radio and college radio were synonymous as far as I could tell.
Yeah, in the 80s,
right. You know, so it was...
Because they're sort of tied together by the same thing, that these are songs that were like, they were bands or artists who were on, who were consciously trying to do something different.
Yeah, yeah.
I outside. Mean, and just connect with listeners, mm-hmm. as opposed to make music like that music over there that is selling. And so if it's selling, I'm going to do it. It's more like, what's in my guts?
Yeah.
How do I connect with people? And that became alternative.
Yeah, I mean, I did an interview with Bill Janovitz from Buffalo Tom, and he was explaining, he's like, well, you know, Bon Jovi was on the radio, and it just didn't seem like anything that I could even aspire to if I wanted to. You know, it just was like this from this other world that didn't really interest, it wasn't related to me or my life. And when he was like talking about his band, he's like, when we started playing, you know, it wasn't to be stars, because that was something you just couldn't be.
Yeah.
It was just like, we just wanted to like go on tour and like meet some people and play. And, you know, it wasn't even about quitting your day job. It was about getting a day job that would let you go on tour. So that type of thing, that the stakes for a lot of these bands, it wasn't about like a, you know, let's get rich, sex, drugs, and rock and roll thing. It was really about trying to connect with an audience, and it was tied in with this community. And if you could get on that circuit, there ended up being a whole alternative tour circuit where, you know, bands could go and play these clubs and they get to know each other and all that type of thing.
So you traced this sort of tension and thread from like the folk era through, like in the book, it sort of begins in the folk era with folks like Dylan.
Yeah.
That this, the sort of the pressure to make music for the sake of sales, versus, you know, making music for that, again, because it's in you to do and because it connects with other people. And you sort of like, there's this thing that happens with folk music and then it becomes rock and roll. Can you do like maybe like a quick, like,
sure.
A quick overview of like, take me from Dylan to Nirvana, and then we'll pick up and chat a little bit in Nirvana, who becomes sort of this icon of the tension.
Well, you almost have to go before Dylan, because like rock music, when it started, didn't have this artistic aspiration. You know, they were, you know, like Elvis wasn't trying to create art, you know, or he ended up doing it, but like his aspiration was to be a popular entertainer. Early rock music in the 50s, you know, Buddy Holly, Chuck Berry, these guys were trying to write popular songs, you know, and they were writing about, you know, pop themes, you know, that weren't particularly deep, you know, it's about cars and, you know, teenage love and all this type of stuff. So that existed before Dylan, you know, and Dylan kind of then introduced into this kind of artistic sensibility, this socio-political sensibility when he went from folk music to rock music. And it created this whole new expectation that rock musicians, in addition to being entertainers, would also have to have something to say or have you know, be artists, you know, be serious artists. So that was kind of a sea change there. And then, and, you know, in Dylan's steps, that, you know, the Beatles got way more artistic. The Beach Boys got way more artistic. These bands that existed before Dylan and had done kind of bubblegum stuff really looked into themselves and kind of stretched themselves and became, you know, great artists. And it just was this explosion from the Velvet Underground to the Grateful Dead to Joni Mitchell, you know, you name your favorite there. And so there's kind of this explosion of artistic influence and artistic aspiration. They thought of themselves as artists too. I mean, that's part of the thing. And they started being taken seriously by critics. You know, rock criticism started with Rolling Stone. And so there was people taking them seriously as artists. And then, of course, you know, but then as that became more popular, there was this kind of pressure, or not even pressure. I don't know that it was imposed from the outside so much as like once those bands became really popular and sold a lot of records, there were a lot of people who wanted to make rock music in order to be popular and sell a lot of records. You know, it wasn't necessarily for these artistic things.
They didn't so much follow the ethos as they were chasing the results.
Yeah. So you had bands like, and I mean, I think Led Zeppelin's a good bridge, and I use that in the book as a bridge of a band that really did have kind of an artistic sensibility, but also really got caught up in this kind of rock star culture and, you know, groupie culture and all that type of stuff. And then it goes through, like, they're kind of a bridge. And then you get to kind of these other bands where that's all there is. You know, like Kiss. Yeah, like, I mean, Gene Simmons, you know, talks, you know, he'll talk about, he's like, it was more like professional wrestling than art.
It absolutely was.
Yeah, you know, so it's like, and he's like, anyone who, he had another quote, and he was talking to Terry Gross at NPR, and he's just like, you know, anyone who gets out there and says, who's doing rock music and says they're doing art is on crack and delusional. The only reason they're doing it is to get laid and make a lot of money.
Right.
So that was his point of view. So, but you had a lot of bands that were like that, and that kind of stretch, that mentality really set the stage for like kind of glam metal bands in the 80s,
yeah,
who were, you know, don't need nothing but a good time, sex, drugs, and rock and roll was just kind of what they were after and the norm.
Yeah, and listeners weren't coming to that stuff with a sense of like, I need a deep connection here. It was just, it was literally just, it's just fun. It's enjoyable.
And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, but for the people who were looking for something deeper, yeah. I mean, like for me, you know, alternative music was an alternative to that. And for a lot of people it was, I think, too. And so then, you know, so but there was this whole, the alternative scene was going on simultaneously with the glam bands. And then in, you know, the early 90s with Nirvana and some of the other bands, Pearl Jam and U2 and a lot of these bands, REM, it started coming into the mainstream and almost became mainstream rock. It almost took over the mainstream from glam bands who stopped being popular, kind of.
Yeah.
And then there was this very brief period where alternative music retained its diversity and was also super popular. So like this 91 to 94 period.
Yeah.
It just was all of those diverse bands that we'd been listening to. Well, it's like, wow, you know, Tori Amos just had like a platinum record or,
yeah.
you know, or whoever it might be, or this Morrissey's record just went gold or, you know, whatever it was. The Cure has a double platinum record, Depeche yeah. Mode, you know, all these bands had all of a sudden were really popular and, but we're still themselves, you know. Yeah. Still
really especially diverse. You think about that Tori Amos record. You even listen to it now.
Yeah.
If that's an album that even that drops, you know, if she released that record now, mm-hmm. it would feel still like, wow, she's really actually, from a standpoint of content, what she's mm-hmm. doing lyrically is still like, wow, that's really powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and she's like unabashedly talking about womanhood.
Absolutely.
And like these, like really. Like, I mean, powerful is not the word I want to use, in these really sort of like provocative ways, mm-hmm. like sort of forcing you to like pay attention to her as a woman, and like
yeah.
and the album sold like crazy.
Yeah,
people
yeah.
loved it.
Yep. And but it was also an example of that, if she had made that album, you know, 5 years later, when alternative meant angsty white guys,
yeah.
you know, like
she might have missed the boat.
She might have missed the boat because that wouldn't have fit the profile, you know? Like, you couldn't... And even, like, there were guys who didn't fit. Like, Morrissey, I mean, who knows if he would have been as big during that era. Because, like, yeah. a sensitive guy, you know,
yes.
you know, wasn't going to be...
Are you calling Morrissey sensitive?
I would say Morrissey's
you feel like, you feel like he's yeah. a little bit sensitive?
Yeah, but you know what I'm saying.
I do.
Yeah, so... But, yeah, so there was... So then, you know... But then, you know, this very brief period ended about the time that Kurt Cobain died. And that's why the book is called Alternative Music Died.
There's also this tension there, and you get into this really interesting juxtaposition. And there's not, like, a full-blown binary here, but mm-hmm. between a band like Pearl Jam... Not a band like Pearl Jam, but between Pearl Jam as a band mm-hmm. and Nirvana as a band. And there was definitely some, like... As I remember the era, and you get to it in the book a little yeah. bit with... There was some kind of tabloidish, like, oh, did you hear what Kurt said about, and did you hear what, you know, Eddie said about, and there was some of, but there really was like the cultural tension that made alternative, like mm-hmm. we're not going to do this for the money and the whole selling out thing. Like those two bands ended up being really kind of symbolic of that tension and that struggle. Can you talk about the relationship there and...
Sure. Well, I mean, it's interesting in the cultural remembrance, and it does have a lot to do with Kurt Cobain's death. I mean, everybody thinks of kind of like Nirvana as this great band that was really revolutionary, and I do think they were great, and there are ways in which they were revolutionary, and everybody nowadays, or not everybody, but there's this cultural perception of Pearl Jam as kind of also-rans and of not being, as being not a good band, or a band that was a commercial band or something like that. And I didn't find that to be the case at the time or in my research. In some ways, Nirvana made more compromises than Pearl Jam did in the sense that they were willing to, you know, continue making music videos, you know, change some of their songs for sale in Kmart and that type of thing, whereas Pearl Jam at some point refused to make music videos.
Yeah, because what was the album? It was the third Nirvana record. There was like
In Utero. Like,
they pulled a song or they changed the lyric or something?
Yeah, they changed Rape Me was the name of the song, and they changed the title to Waif Me, I think that was, or something like that.
Yeah.
And I remember that it being a controversy at the time, and
it makes you think of that the if you remember the Doors movie,
yeah
when there's the scene where they're supposed to go on the Ed, oh darn it, what's the show,
is it the Ed Sullivan show?
The Ed Sullivan show, and they're like, hey, so this line about getting high,
yeah,
we'd like you to change it and yeah. say something like, hey, we couldn't get much better.
Yeah. We couldn't get much higher.
And then he's like, oh, yeah, sure. And then he goes out there and mm-hmm. he looks it right square in the camera and he says the word high.
Yep.
And sort of, you know, it's that moment. It's like, oh, like, okay, here's an artist kind of being a jerk about it, but he's, I'm going to be true to myself. Yeah. Whereas, like, Cobain was apparently okay with being like, yeah, we'll change the lyric to sell it in Kmart.
Well, yeah, I think he wanted to be commercially successful, and he wanted to create, I mean, Cobain in some ways as the centerpiece of the book makes sense because he wanted to be commercially successful and he wanted to create authentic art. And I think he never really was able to resolve that issue within himself. Mm. So he's a contradiction. It's kind of this tension, this... you know, living with tension, living with mystery, you know, like those types of nuance, you know, holding things in tension. I think that was a part of his personality. I think...
like he sort of either felt or forced a choice on himself that maybe he didn't necessarily have to make, but sort of like ended up being really torn by.
Yeah, I think he was torn by it. And I think Pearl Jam reacted in somewhat of a different way in that they really decided we don't want to try and be popular. And I think they almost made records in the late 90s that were intentionally trying to be non-commercial.
Mm.
And it was interesting, by the new millennium, they kind of reclaimed some of their indie cred because their albums hadn't been as popular, you know, which is interesting.
But they kept on making them.
And they kept on making them.
They never quit.
Yeah, they never quit. So... and so I see Pearl Jam as kind of a really cool story, and I don't necessarily see them as kind of the what is it, the redheaded stepbrother or whatever it is to Nirvana. You know, I see them as symbiotic in a lot of ways, and
that's a great review of the history. You talk about a little bit. It was fascinating. It's like you had this moment in the book you talked about. I'm just going to go back to this for a second. You talked about Led Zeppelin,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and that like you're just not that like people like, oh, you're supposed to love Led Zeppelin in the way that you're supposed to love. It's like these sort of like, if you love rock and roll, it's like if you love football, you kind of have to love Brett Favre and the Packers.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was like Led Zeppelin's like on this, and for you like, they're not really on my list because they're a fine band, but they weren't. They're just not like a favorite of yours to some degree because of that bridge.
Yeah, I mean, I try and avoid talking at most points during the book. I try and avoid talking about bands in the first person because I'm not. It's not supposed to be about my opinion, but the critics on Led Zeppelin did plenty of the talking. You know, because critics really didn't like Led Zeppelin in the 1970s. They were really thought that they had embraced this rock star culture and were no longer kind of pursuing art, and so they were upfront about that, and so I tend to agree with that assessment.
Yeah.
I don't see that much value in kind of rock star culture in and of itself.
Yeah.
Right. So that assessment resonates with me, and I hadn't grown up like listening to Led Zeppelin. They were before my time, and so a lot of the alternative bands that I was listening to reacting against that kind of mainstream rock, sex, drugs, and rock and roll thing.
Yeah.
That also, frankly, had a lot of kind of misogynistic overtones, had homophobic overtones, and that was really that alternative music was a refuge from that. And so like that, you know, started with like kind of groupie culture in the 70s, but then, you know, you take it up through Guns N' Roses.
Yeah.
And like it makes its way into the lyrics, and you read like lyrics to like songs like One in a Million or Back Off Bitch, and you know, there's this whole kind of misogynistic testosterone thing happening in that music that was not attractive to me and was not attractive to a lot of people in the alternative scene.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, what's interesting is that that doesn't really make it in the cultural remembrance that much either. People think of Guns N' Roses as this, you know, great band. And they, I mean, from a technical standpoint, I think they have a lot of good stuff. But it's hard for me, because of the context in which I encountered them, to separate that from their kind of misogyny and homophobia and all that type of stuff.
And it is an interesting thing to watch those songs. Because this is them or the Cult and like when we talk about misogyny, like folks will come down the mountain all day on rappers,
right?
But not in the same way. They won't do the same thing with Axl Rose.
Mm-hmm.
It's this really interesting split where it's like rap is somehow more, you know, is identified as more misogynistic, whereas like, I don't hear a whole lot of people talk about, like, well, you know, Led Zeppelin didn't do a whole lot for the image of women.
Right. Right. You don't hear that much. And it's interesting that it gets kind of overlooked. Although, I mean, I would say, like, Eminem kind of got, he got some pass on it too. I mean, people, critics, I mean, I think it, I mean, but it goes to your point as far as the racial thing too. I mean, in just given our culture, I think a lot of times white people can get away with more than people of color.
It's a little bit.
It's a sad fact, but to pretend like it's otherwise, I think would be kind of, you know, silly.
Yeah, it would be also irresponsible. You brought up criticism, and one of the great threads in your book has to do with the role of criticism,
mm-hmm.
Which is not a topic of conversation, I would say, often enough. Like it's sort of like who watches the watchers as a question.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Who's paying attention to rock criticism? Because rock criticism had a moment in which it played a really, really important role in, like, being something of an advocate,
mm-hmm.
specifically for alternative rock.
Mm-hmm.
And then started kind of quitting along the lines there. And it was like, in the same way that, like, critics, like, recognized, like, this band Zeppelin, meh. But then everyone started changing their tune, mm-hmm. after a while. Can you talk a little bit about, like, there's Rolling Stone and how Rolling Stone changed, and then sort of the emergence of Pitchfork.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, Rolling Stone started was very much influential in kind of this changing perception of rock. This is in the late 60s as being something that was worthy of serious criticism. And it was, Rolling Stone was also very, very countercultural. It was like kind of the voice of the counterculture.
Hmm.
So they established, you know, in the early 1970s, you know, they were willing to pan, you know, Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath and these, like, other popular bands, because they just, you know, I mean, their line on Black Sabbath was that they were eternally foiled by their own stupidity, you know?
That's a line from one of the reviews.
From one of the reviews.
Oh,
and it's like,
line.
You know, and it's like, and they were willing to say this about, a, you know, kind of a popular, you know, rock band. And agree or disagree, you know, it took some balls to be, you know, to be willing to criticize these popular bands.
They were trying to be responsible to, like, an actual, like, critical ethic.
Yeah.
As opposed to pandering.
Yes.
To the audience.
I mean, I think it's important to make a distinction because it's, you know, rock criticism and popular music criticism are kind of synonymous these days. But rock music criticism started not because they thought everything that was popular was worthy of serious criticism.
Huh.
It was because they thought rock music specifically had taken on these artistic qualities that were worthy of serious criticism.
They're thinking there was sort of a mission at the heart of the movement.
So that was kind of where that came from. And so they treated music that way. And there was kind of this, like, independent artistic standard that they used that they were willing to criticize rock bands. It wasn't like if you were a rock band, that didn't make you, like, somehow immune from criticism from Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
That changed, you know, it changed throughout the 70s, but in the 80s, as rock music started to lose kind of its popular hegemony, you know, and it was starting to feel threatened by hip-hop and country music's resurgence and just, you know, the popular just pop music generally, there was kind of this sense that it started to be like criticizing a rock band was like criticizing a member of your own team.
Huh.
And Rolling Stone realized that in order to continue on as a viable publication, rock music needed to remain popular. And so they started kind of relaxing their standards and, you know, putting Bon Jovi on the cover or whatever. And but then it kind of necessitated this whole rethinking of their whole critical history. And so they would put out these record guides from time to time where they'd assess all these different albums. And you can watch the record guides from the first one was in 1979, then 83, then 92, then 2003. And you can just watch like Black Sabbath's star rating go up each time they put out a record guide, or these other mainstream, you know, popular 70s bands, or Guns N' Roses, or right. you know, just bands that they may have had a more critical eye. All of a sudden, they were creating this mythology in which rock music was inherently valuable, regardless of its artistic intent. So that was really interesting. And then, so that continued right up, you know, through the 90s. And so they, in conjunction with all these kind of sycophantic rock documentaries, like, you know, Behind the Music and VH1 Legends and all these different things where, you know, they're putting on the, you know, REM is... and John Lennon are suddenly on the same level as Motley Crue and Kiss because they've all got these documentaries about them. We kind of just mushed it all together,
yeah.
Where there wasn't any good or bad or worthwhile or not worthwhile or
and
artistic.
And more to the point, it didn't matter what they were up to. Like it didn't matter, like because Motley Crue is trying to do something very different
right.
than what R.E.M. is trying, and it didn't matter. Like the criticism stopped paying attention to like what's R.E.M. actually after
yeah.
and trying to do, and what that makes them completely different yeah. than Motley Crue.
Yeah, 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 and they got caught up in the famous line from every Behind the Music is when it gets to the nightmare descent into booze and pills,
right.
you know, and it's kind of got yes. this like melodramatic like let's tell that story, and so like obviously Motley Crue has a great story when it comes to that,
yes, they do.
And so that you know, but again, it just kind of this rock star culture became yeah. kind of you know just synonymous with it just got all kind of muddled up into this mythology. So around the turn of the millennium, critics who started kind of calling bullshit on that.
Yeah.
And so there was like, well, it was a descendant of this kind of cultural studies project that had been going on in the universities where, you know, you're deconstructing things and looking at things from a feminist perspective.
Right.
And looking at, or the LGBT perspective, and looking at how do canons of literature or art or music get created, and it just seems to always support this kind of heterosexual white male power structure, and so they're just kind of like, and now rock music criticism is doing that too.
Yep.
And so there was a real questioning of that, and all of that kind of got dubbed like what they now call it kind of rockism.
Hmm.
Are you familiar with that term?
No.
It's just this term to denote like rock-centric assessments of music. So,
oh, fascinating.
But the problem is when they dismissed all the mythology, they also dismissed kind of this appeal to artistic standards. They didn't make any distinction
yeah.
because rock criticism at that time wasn't making any distinction. And it led to kind of this whole other thing in criticism that is that got called poptimism, where it's just an embracing of all pop culture
yeah.
and that artistic standards are for kind of elitists and... Huh. Pop music is more more like the music of it's populist,
yeah.
you know, rather than elitist.
Yeah, yeah.
But the irony there is that then you're just kind of embracing whatever these big corporations are putting out.
Yes, there's nothing populist about saying like what these millionaires and billionaires are telling me to like something, so I'm going to like it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, saying Celine Dion is a populist artist because she's popular is kind of ridiculous. I mean, when she's got like this, you know, multi-million dollar campaign behind her. And so the book, you know, it was really hard to try and not fall into these traps of taking on a point of view that you couldn't later criticize.
Yeah.
Because
right.
all of
yeah.
it ends up being flawed.
Huh.
And so you have to be willing to criticize rock mythology while saying, but actually I think there's something to like these artistic standards. I think there's something to
yeah.
trying to hold music to, you know, to some kind of standard like that.
There's also a moment you get to where you talk about the rock criticism and the sort of the star ratings kind of rising for whoever, and the way that Radiohead has this moment where they kind of break the system.
They do
with,
break the system,
with
yeah.
Kid A.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you tell that story?
Well, I mean, this is at the time where all this mythology is being built up about rock music, and it's just they're creating this canon and these the immortals and all this different type of stuff. And so Radiohead releases what they think is an FU to commercialism when they
yeah.
released OK Computer.
Yeah.
They think it's like this criticism of commercialism, but instead the rock establishment really embraces it and
yes.
loves it, and it's because it's using kind of terms and method and guitar licks in order to say these things, and they're kind of instead of becoming outcast, they get a slap on the back like, well done.
Well, they dropped a 5-minute and 36-second single with Paranoid Android.
Yeah, yeah.
And like everyone's riding like 315 to 318
yeah.
to 330 tops. And they drop a song that's 5-minute, 36-second
song. It has these distinct sections. You know, it's got this whole prog rock section.
It's got three movements.
Yeah, exactly. So they're doing all this stuff that they think is going to be, and they're really critical of kind of this kind of commercial stuff going on. And then the commercial mainstream says, great, okay, let's do that again. And so they go through this, like Radiohead kind of goes through this identity crisis and is like, well, if we're going to say F you to the system, we can't use terms that the system understands. So they
yeah.
release, you know, Kid A. There was kind of a combination of that, plus Tom York just having writer's block at the time and kind of writing these really kind of elliptical, you know, snatches of lyrics that don't follow the same, you know, kind of tried and true rock formulas.
Yeah.
And so that ends up causing this, like, right in the middle of rock mythology, this kind of fissure right down the middle of it, where there's some people are like, well, this isn't rock music. Like, we can't like this. This doesn't use terms. You're supposed to be a rock band. We don't like this. And then there's other bands, the other guys are like, but we just said they're the greatest band ever with their last album. How do we go back on that?
18 months ago.
Yeah, they're immortal. So them. They must be doing something right. So it created this whole kind of confusion that led to, that led to kind of open this space for somebody like Pitchfork to kind of come in and be like, you know what, this is great art. And it doesn't matter what, you know, rock, you know, forms it uses. This is just great art. And we're going to embrace this wholeheartedly. And not only that, we're going to embrace all kinds of these, this other underground indie stuff that's happening. And they had a lot more credibility. I mean, rock music, traditional rock music criticism, Rolling Stone had kind of lost all that by the turn of the millennium. So there was this natural place for Pitchfork to come in. And Pitchfork just did some really amazing stuff throughout that first decade of the 2000s with exposing indie music and that.
So let's wrap it up like this. What are you listening to now that gets you, that you're like, yeah, I feel like I'm in this. Like, what are you loving right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, I listened to so much stuff in writing the book that there was some stuff that I knew from these different eras and the other stuff that I was discovering for the first time. So I found a lot of new stuff there that was older stuff that I really started liking. But I really liked, you know, as I was reconnecting with kind of the music of just the last 10 or 15 years, I think it's been really a golden era for rock music creation. So all kinds of stuff that I just continue to listen to over these last few years, whether it's, you know, Arcade Fire or Nico Case or The National or Vampire Weekend or Fleet Foxes, all these different types of bands that I just I really enjoy, and like War on Drugs, and it's, you know, Father John Misty, and all these all these random, you know, kind of bands that I still listen to from these last, you know, 10 years or so. Sufjan Stevens, and I'm going to forget about all the bands, you know, but
it's all the bands. I like all the bands.
Yeah, but there's just so much great music, it's hard to even keep up with. And I find myself now, like, I know that there's new stuff coming out that I can't keep up with. Huh. I haven't had the brain space to do it. I now have four kids who are under the age of who are six, ages six and under.
Oh wow!
So I'm a busy man doing that. You know,
so little Sufjan and then a little Rafi.
No. We actually like really try and stay away from like trying to get them into kids music. We, you know, they find the stuff within our music that they love. Like, my 3-year-old daughter is like obsessed with the Blues Brothers right now.
Oh, that's fantastic.
You know, and she just like,
that's fantastic.
Yeah, she just like, can we put on that? And like, and you know, my sons, I mean, they're obsessed. You know, they'll want to listen to what are some of the, Aha, you know, Take On Me is one of my son's favorite songs. And, you know, so it's just, you know, we encourage them to kind of like the stuff that they like, that's actual, like, kind of, we don't want to dumb it down for them. There's all kinds of, they love the Beatles.
Well, you get to kind of flip the script, right? Yeah. You get to like do for your kids what your dad had done for you, and sort of curate this like historical music experience and pass on the gift you were given.
I hope so. I hope we do as my dad did. I mean, and my dad and my mom, I mean, they did a great job with that. So
that's really good. Well, Adam, thanks for your time.
Sure. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the At Sea Podcast. Patrons had access to this episode ahead of its release date, and if you'd like to join them in helping support this particular work, well, then you get to add to the tension between art and money in my life by supporting this work financially. You can also follow up with any of the resources mentioned in my conversation with Adam by jumping to atseapodcast.com. And you can help potential listeners decide to give this one a shot by leaving a positive review at iTunes. Until next time.